with one exception, I try to take the information, and if they're not putting it into words that my mind can understand, especially when it comes to their emotions, I will rephrase it back to them and say something like, I understand that that call was really hard for you, and it sounds like you might be angry about this. And then it gives them a chance to say, yeah, you know what? That is what I'm angry about.
Thank you for tuning in to the Critical Conversations podcast, brought to you by Mind the Frontline. Established in 2023 as a 501c3, Mind the Frontline is your ally in the journey to support those who selflessly safeguard our communities. Their core mission revolves around pioneering innovation in research, education, and overall well-being, specifically tailored to healthcare, military, and public service frontline first responders. The Critical Conversation podcast is a dedicated space for police, fire, EMS, allied health workers, dispatchers, air medical, and military personnel, along with their families. Here, we dive into the heart of the matter, tackling essential topics such as mental health strategies, recovery methods, treatment options, the latest research, and professional development opportunities. Before we dive into today's episode on Critical Conversations, we do want to, however, acknowledge the nature of our discussions. Some of the content discussed may be triggering or intense as we explore the challenges and the triumphs within the first responder community. We recognize that these discussions may evoke strong emotions or memories. If you or someone you know is struggling and needs immediate support, we urge you to reach out to your agency's mental health resources or your local peer support group. In time of mental health crisis, you can always contact the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline by phone or via text at 988. Please remember, you are never alone and help is always available. At Mind the Frontline, we are more than just a podcast. We are a community committed to fostering resilience within the entire first responder family. So whether you're on the front lines or supporting those who are, we invite you to subscribe, engage, and be a part of this vital mission. To learn more, please visit us at www.mindthefrontline.org. Now let's dive into today's critical conversation. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Mind Matters Episode 1, where we're going to be talking about peer support 101. We have our assistant director at Mind the Frontline Peer Support, Brett Zingarelli, here. He's going to be the main speaker of tonight, but this is our inaugural kind of kickoff, so we would love to hear your thoughts in the chat or comments on the Facebook page, just to kind of let us know how this goes. We want to continue to do the first 3 episodes at no charge. This is actually going to become a benefit, not only for our members. So if you do not have a Mind the Frontline membership, you could always go to www.mindthefrontline.org. And just check out our membership options. It does provide you access to webinars like these, special events that we put on, along with our catalog of state-by-state resources. We also have blogs and podcasts and other videos, and we're just adding more and more all the time. But we do plan on using this episode and episodes that follow in the Mind Matters series to go ahead and kind of create some continuing education for peer support responders. We know that we typically all go through some initial training, and then, you know, it's just kind of how do we keep up on that? And so having some of these good discussions, we're starting out with just our own team for the first few episodes, but then we're going to be having some guest lecturers on each month on these webinars to really kind of inform us of what the current things are going on, or maybe what's coming down the stream. So we really just appreciate everybody being on, and really appreciate your time joining us today. And with that, I want to turn it over to our assistant director of peer support, Brett Zingarelli. Brett, go ahead and take it away and kind of tell us a little bit about yourself, and let's go ahead and kick this thing off.
Good morning and afternoon, everybody. My name is Brett Zingarelli. I'm the assistant director of peer support here at Mind the Frontline. It's a little background about myself. I started in EMS in 1996 for a little bit of the right reasons, a little bit of the wrong reasons. Watched some family members of mine get really sick when I was at a young age, and I really wanted to figure out how to do more to help my family get through that process. And then getting into high school, I literally watched somebody get out of class and walk out the door to go on an ambulance call. And I was like, how do I do that? And I joined the volunteer ambulance corps at the time, got out of high school, went in the Army, did some time in the Army as a medic, got out just before 9/11, was a 9/11 responder, went back in the Army. And then I've worked urban 911 EMS ever since. I've been involved in some level of peer support with critical incident stress management for about 20 years. I lead a team here at my agency that I started and run now that's been, I would say, very successful. I'm a part of the state team here in the state of Delaware. I oversee education, mental health, community services, critical care, interfacility transport at my current full-time job. And I also work on the street as a 911 paramedic because I like using up all of my time. But what I want to talk about today, and I want to have a really broad discussion about peer support and what's a peer support looks like, how it's applicable to you and your organization, and the people that you work with, and why it's so important. The thing that I really just want to start with is what is peer support? What does it look like? Because when people hear peer support, everybody thinks of critical incident stress management, and that's not the end all be all of peer support. And yes, I've been through all the critical incident stress management courses. I'm actually board certified in critical incident stress management, but that's not where it starts and ends. Where it starts and ends is with you as a person out there working with your partner and keeping your eyes open to what's going on around you with the people you work with and yourself. Like, are you actually keeping your eyes open to your own emotions? Do you have that emotional intelligence to understand what it looks like when you're having stress and when that stress is starting to cascade into bigger problems? Who needs peer support, right? Like, is it something that every single person needs after every single shift? No, that's not what peer support looks like. Peer support is a continuous thing that's happening 24 hours a day in a healthy work environment or volunteer environment, if that's your agency. It's something that is built into a culture, not something that is on an as needed basis. And if you can build that into the culture of your agency, you're going to see huge strides in the performance of the folks that are working for you and their ability to project in EMS into bigger things, because they're going to build that resilience and that tolerance for those calls that affect them. Because the calls that affect people are different for everyone. The calls that affect me and give me stress aren't the same calls that are going to affect you and give you that same level of stress. For me, teenagers are just the absolute worst for me, not because they talk back or are any of the stereotypical teenage thing. It's that they've gotten to the point in their life where they're about to be able to take control for themselves. And they've done all the steps of going to school because they had to and doing the things that their parents said because that's what they had to do. And they're on the cusp of being 100% their own person and having that freedom. And then something tragic happens and that gets pulled away from them and they can't do it anymore. That destroys me. But I can go on those pediatric calls and walk away and not have the same moral injury that I get from those adolescents or the adults in the geriatrics. And you know, maybe it's geriatrics that you have the problem with because of the relationship you had with your grandparents, or, you know, it doesn't matter what the call is for you. What matters is the way that it affects you and that we can all do better to take care of each other. Because at the end of the day, like, y'all are family, right? Like, when I have a partner at work and it's the guy that I worked with for the last 5 or 6 years, he's my family now. And everything that he's going through in his life is something that I'm going through in my life. Especially if you work a 24-hour shift, you're coming in and that's, you see that person more than you see anyone else in your entire life. And keeping them mentally well is super important to me, and I hope it's super important to you. So let's talk a little bit about how that peer support process starts in that intimate relationship with, you know, your partner or the couple of people that you, you know, at work and you're working with all the time. So you're not necessarily a peer support responder out to another agency, but you're just simply functioning in your job role. What you need to remember is that their issue isn't your issue. So if somebody says, hey, you know what, I'm really stressed out. That call we went on last week, it's really weighing heavy on me. It was a pediatric call and it just didn't go well. And I feel like we could have did better. And I'm not sleeping well at night. When someone says something like that to you, the first thought in your mind can't be, oh, I remember when that happened to me. Or, well, yeah, I was there and this is how I've processed that already. Because they aren't you. They're not having the same reaction that you are. And your response to those stressors in the past is not the same as their response now. And the reason that that happens, and the reason that everybody doesn't go through the same level of response to every call, is because our emotions come from a part of our brain that can't process language. It's our limbic brain, that lizard brain that gives us all our instant reactions and our fight or flight response, and our instincts. And there's no ability for language to be processed there. So it's not surprising that people have a hard time putting words to their emotions. So when you think about that a little bit, and I say that I'm angry over anything, you know, my kids weren't listening today and that made me angry. Well, when I say that to you, you know what angry means to you, but you don't know what angry means to me. You know, it's to think about that, it's wild, right? Like, here are all these things that I think that I kind of understand about my own emotions, and I want to prescribe that to every single other person that I meet, but they're having their own experience. And that's the same in these traumatic events. They're having their own experience, and the reactions that they're having are normal for anyone that's going through such an abnormal situation. And normalizing those emotions and those reactions is the number one thing that we have to do here in peer support. So rather than saying, hey, this is what I did, the goal in the beginning is to put yourself in their shoes. Try to walk the current experience that they're having, and then understand how hard it is for them to move forward in what they're experiencing. The other thing that a lot of people that are early in peer support do is look at a call. Like, let's say you have a pediatric cardiac arrest, because that's just something that a lot of people tie some very heavy emotions to. You go out on that pediatric cardiac arrest and you get the save. You get Rosk in the field, and the kid's awake, alert, and oriented when you get to the ED, and the prognosis looks good. I walk out of that call out to the ambulance like I am a champion. It's the best thing that's ever happened to me. And the next 6 months, I'm riding that high. Like, it doesn't matter what the next 50 calls are, because I saved this kid and it was the worst thing ever, and I made it work. And that's resilience for me. That's eustress. That's the stress that makes me better. But my partner on that same call with that same successful outcome may be completely broken from that call. the stress may have completely destroyed my partner and they are not okay. And they're not going to be okay. Maybe for a long time over a call that was successful. We don't think about that in this industry. We look at those calls and go, I don't know why they're upset. Like that couldn't have gone any better. Well, they're upset because they are, and that's okay. And that leads me in a little bit to some of the changes that are happening. I hate to use the hot topic of like generational changes, but specifically post COVID, there's a lot of changes in the workforce, particularly in medicine, but in all lines of work. Think about your typical 22 to 25 year old that's getting into this industry right now, or just started at the beginning of COVID. So that Gen Z population, anybody that's that old has had a cell phone and access to media since they were able to hold it in their hand. They have access to all the information in the world and also all the news that's happening in the world. We've painted a picture for these folks that life is fragile, tragedy is happening 24 hours a day. They've never existed in a world where America wasn't in a war. And then we're going to tell you that there's a virus coming that we don't know anything about, and it might kill 50% of the population. We're not sure yet. And if you work in healthcare, by the way, we're going to force you into that. We don't have enough PPE to prepare you to deal with that. If you worked at agencies that are big, you were probably wearing a trash bag instead of a gown because you didn't have enough. You're wearing an N95, probably for the first time outside of a fit testing ever in your life. Walking up to the fourth floor of an apartment building, you can't breathe, you can't treat somebody. I mean, it was truly hell in the beginning of COVID. And that's these kids' first experience in a job where they came out to help people. And we want to say, oh, well, this new generation, they're not like us. They don't dedicate themselves. They don't, you know, they don't look at it like whatever we got to do to put ambulances on the street. Like, I don't care how sick I am. I'm going to go in today because we're already short staffed and there's norovirus tearing through my department because it's tearing through my department right now. And we had almost half a shift call out yesterday, but you know what? I'm going in anyway, because that's the way we do it in this industry. Well, it's not the way we do it in this industry anymore. And, you know, I actually kind of hate that I still have that mindset, because I absolutely understand where they're coming from. Nothing in life is certain. And we see that every single day that we walk in the door. So I don't blame them when they say, you know what? I woke up today and I can't do it today. And they call out of work. And you know what? Sometimes it's a late call out and it's a violation of policy and it ends up in a write-up. And now we're inflicting moral injury on someone that literally couldn't do it today. They just couldn't do it. And now they're in a progressive discipline policy because our policy and procedures are written in a manner that aren't viable for the mental health of our organization, right? And that's my TED talk on that. Not that that's a lot to do with peer support, but it is a lot to do with the mindset of the people that are getting in this industry right now. And I think people that are my age, I'm 43 years old and I've been doing this since I was 16. It took a minute for me to wrap my head around that, to understand that everybody walking in the door today isn't me walking in the door when I was in high school. And that's kind of my 1,000-foot view on peer support in a nutshell. I know we have some questions coming in. Chris, if you'd like to funnel any of those at me real quick before I start getting into what we're actually looking for when we get into some of these issues.
Absolutely. We did have a good question come across the chat. So generational differences in emergency services has always been a significant issue. What do you feel are the best takeaways when having these conversations across generations, i.e. cross-generational partners seeing signs and symptoms of emotional distress? So, you know, if I see someone, you know, I've been in it for 23 years, you've been in it older than dirt. But when you look at it, when we have these new individuals coming into the field or coming into practice, these younger EMTs, these younger paramedics that are sometimes, you know, not too far out of high school, you know, and we've been in it for 23 years. I think you mentioned a little bit of this, like, you know, I try to remember that I am not the same, you know, this is not the same when I came into it 23 years ago. But what are some of those conversations or takeaways that you feel like would be beneficial for that cross-generational gap that we do see oftentimes in EMS?
Well, that is a great question, first off. So one of the things that sparked in my mind immediately is that people are getting into EMS for different reasons than we got into EMS. And when I say that, it's not that, you know, I got in to help people, and it's not that they're not getting in to help people. It's that when I got into EMS, I just wanted to be a paramedic, and like, I was going to be a paramedic forever. And that's what I'm doing. But the newer generations aren't getting into EMS to be an EMT or a paramedic for the rest of their lives. They're doing it as part of their bigger experience into whatever they want to do in medicine. Like, so my department, one of the big things we pride ourselves on is that we lose probably 4 or 5 people a year to PA school or med school, and then another probably 5 to 10 people a year to nursing school. A lot of departments would take that as a negative. We actually take that as a positive, and we actually advertise that as part of our recruitment process. Like, come use us as your stepping stone. We want to see you move through medicine. And part of that, when you think about it on this side of the world, on the mental health side, is that not only is a moral injury or PTSD threat a threat to their existence in this job, it's a threat to their entire future plan. Like, okay, like, you know, every paramedic's angry and salty and whatever, and they all have PTSD, and, you know, and because that's what I thought when I was young. Like, oh, that's just the normal. Like, I'm okay because I'm just acting like everybody else. But these kids aren't going to be okay with that normal, because this is only a stop for them. And those sort of problems are going to prevent them from taking those next steps, from going into bigger and better places for them in medicine. And we don't want to stop the future of medicine, right? We don't want to stop somebody from being a doctor because they had a terrible call on an ambulance. And so we need to understand that entire process is different for them just right there. And then what I talked about a little bit, just about those generational differences and the way they were brought up and the media that was available to them, because I didn't have a cell phone until I got out of the Army. I was in my mid-20s. And my cell phone was an actual Nokia cellular phone that, you know, cost money to send a text message. There was no internet on it. I couldn't get the news. I didn't have access to all that media. The only way I got news was turning on the news. And I never did that when I was in the Army. I didn't, you know, go out and see movies or do any of those things. So I didn't have exposure to those type of things. So it took me a long time to adjust to someone that has that amount of exposure and has had it since essentially the day they were born. Because, you know, Facebook is a news source for a lot of people, whether it's good news or bad news or accurate news or right. not, that doesn't matter, because that's their reality. That information coming in, and it's going to be 100% their truth, even if it's false, until proven otherwise. And, and, and that instant gratification. You know, the news now isn't even the same as the news it was when we were young. The news when we were young, you know, they used to broadcast the most accurate news, and you know, that's not what the news broadcast. Now it's you heard it here first, and it doesn't matter if it was right or wrong. It's that it got out first, and that retraction that comes out 2 days later because they had the information wrong, nobody's getting that information. That's trickled down over the next 30 days, maybe to 50% of the people that saw it in the first place. And when I say 50%, I know it's not even close to that number.
Yeah, I think when you look at the new generation coming in, it's just being understanding, you know, having a different perspective. You know, there's old, you know, we talk about the old salty dog. You talk about the old timers. What really impresses me about some of the old timers are those that are able to approach these type of situations and these type of maybe nuances for them anyways, with grace and humility, because, you know, I think having that grace and humility does allow you to kind of keep your perspective open to these people, this new generation of EMS workers and first responders. They have a different perspective. They've been exposed to different things that we typically have not been exposed to before, or not until later on in our lives. And, you know, being 40 myself, like, I didn't get a cell phone until after I graduated high school, you know, and so now I see 10-year-olds walking around with iPhones, getting, you know, Facebook, TikTok, you know, and they do. My kids, you know, I don't give them a phone by any means, but, you know, they watch the YouTube channels on TV and they watch the little TikTok things and the reels. And, you know, then they come up to dad like, oh, this is this. And I have to sit there and explain to them with grace and not frustration that, hey, this is not true. Or here are some of the facts and here are some things and tools to be aware of. But I think just, you know, if we have that cross-generational gap, it's really, you know, being understanding of where they're at in their point in life and where we're at in our point in life, and how do we bridge that together, right? And bring the good from both sides, because then it makes it productive and we can start having these conversations a little bit easier. You know, and I will say, you know, it's hard because we got to teach this new younger generational, young generation, to bring in humility and some of these other things and take away some of the arrogance and ego of, hey, look, I'm an EMT now. Like, I get some of these things. But we're also seeing that maybe some of these new hires, just like the old salty dogs, like myself, you know, the emotional intelligence is there could be a good difference in that. And so when you look at, hey, how do we carry these conversations between a large gap? It can effectively be done. It does take two people. And even then, if it's just one good person that is armed with some good skills and knowledge and can bring in that humility, I think there can be some really good conversation to just say, hey, you know, how you feeling? You know, and that might be a different, there's different terms and the terms are always changing. We're trying to stay up with it as an organization. But I do see a lot of these new nuances kind of presenting themselves. So I love that question. And it was a fantastic answer.
And you mentioned emotional intelligence. I'm glad you mentioned that, because some of these kids that are coming in to this industry now are so much more emotionally intelligent than I ever was in my 20s. I had no understanding of the things that I was feeling in my 20s, right? Like, I happy and sad. You know, angry. Those were the emotions that I had in my 20s. These kids are plugged in, and they really do understand the way that they're feeling, and that plays a huge part into them walking into the door every single day. And particularly to the folks in leadership, I think it's our job to understand that. And it's our job as leaders in this industry to navigate them through the industry, not expect them to conform to our industry, right? Like, they are the future. The industry needs to move to them, not the other way around. And I don't know what that looks like.
I don't know what that looks like either, but I can honestly tell you. But yeah, I love how you put that, Brett, because I think a lot of times, especially in EMS, fire, public safety, you know, we're kind of rooted in tradition, right? So it's like, hey, this is the way we've kind of always done it. And I don't want to kind of use that as a catchphrase, but what I want to do is kind of bring it as an analogy, because I do think the industry has been slow to respond to this new generation, and we are expecting them to come meet us where we're at. And in reality, you know, we need to take a hard look at ourselves as an industry and go, do we need to reverse that and meet them? I love how you said it. Let's meet them where they're at, because honestly, that's where the times are going. When you look at a lot of these progressive industries outside of public safety, tech, sales, online, you know, marketing, things like that, they're very adaptive and they're very astute to what the new generation is bringing as far as emotional intelligence, what their needs are, because the needs that that we needed when we came into the profession have completely changed, almost, you know, been flipped to a degree, to the point where the new one's coming in. For example, looking at tech companies, you know, instead of doing the old like office strategy, you know, they have open common, you know, common workspaces, you know, they provide activities and fulfillment, because they understand that the emotional part, the emotional psyche actually plays a really big part as far as product output. So we can say, hey, if I feel emotionally great about what I'm doing, and I like how we had that in the chat, you know, there's a huge impact on how the process, psychological and vicarious trauma and the motivations for why we do this work that we do. So feeling emotionally sound and feeling happy and fulfilled, you know, is going to allow me to go a lot further than, you know, when I start hitting these emotional landmines and I don't know how to kind of cope with that, or the industry is resistant to that change, you know, because then it's like, am I off? Am I the one that's wrong? Because I'm looking around on social media and Facebook and all these initiatives for DEI and just as examples, but we're not really kind of adjusting that, I think, as quick as we probably could. But I would love to hear your thoughts on that before we move on to the next topic.
No, you just nailed it, Chris, because if we were doing it right, there wouldn't be peer support teams. There wouldn't be a need for Mind the Front Line. There would be a culture of peer support across the industry. And that culture of peer support would just be ingrained into everything. And it would be from the time you brought an employee in until the time they exit, whether that's 6 months or 25 years later, they're just a part of that peer support process. And that involves everyone in your organization, from the new generation to the old generation, working together and keeping an eye on everyone. And unfortunately, we are so far from that in this industry. I think a really good way to start making the right strides in that direction are in education. From the initial EMT class all the way through the critical care levels, I think we should be building peer support into those programs. And when people are coming out of those classes and getting on, you know, on their feet, once they're through that field training and they're comfortable where they are, because we're not trying to beat them up with, we're already killing them in the field training process, right? Like, it's stressful for everybody. Even if you have a really good program, it's still going to be stressful. People are still going to be worried about failing. But once you're through that and you have that behind you, you should be giving folks a chance to be involved in this kind of a thing immediately. Because if you get them involved in the beginning, you get that grassroots involvement, they're going to get other people involved. Just like I do when I do departmental education and we run an academy, you know, we bring people in, we teach them how to be an EMT, we get them out, get them through the FTO process. And now I get them to be a stop the bleed instructor, and I want them to go out and teach stop the bleed in their own community, because now they're building community relations. They're feeling like a part of the team, and I'm building instructors from that generation almost from the moment that they started working for us. And now when I have my next class, they're going to look and go, hey, there's people like me that are already teaching these things. Well, if we can do that in peer support, I think that's what the future needs to look like. I hope it's a good idea.
No, you definitely did. You know, I think bringing that to culture, you know, and culture is king. I have always kind of said that in some of my lectures, and it's just because when you do have a positive culture, you do have things like peer support that thrive, emotional support, you know, thrives, you know, being tuned into how your fellow coworkers are feeling or what they're going through. All of that becomes more transparent because it feels safe, and it feels safe, you know, that's when the real kind of culture shift starts happening and we can maintain things because everybody has a bad day. We know that. But how do we ride that wave? Sometimes, you know, we can ride it ourselves. Sometimes we have the tools, sometimes we don't have the tools. And so when you do have a culture, and I think that's one of the things and why Mind the Frontline exists is to, you know, make it more aware and educate the industries, about culture, about the need to make adjustments and change and meet the new generation where they're at. Otherwise, that gap is going to continue to get wider and wider. And some companies we already know from history are not going to change. They're going to be resilient to this. They're going to fight it tooth and nail and say, you know what, I didn't get that when I grew up. Like, you're not getting it either. You know, for me, I think that's a lot of BS and a lot of ego. And I think we need to, you know, and those organizations won't thrive. Those are the ones that you see constant turnover. They're always hiring. They can't fill trucks. They're constantly burning through overtime, which eventually is going to bankrupt that company. So it's kind of, for me, it's like you almost want to shake the CEO or the chief or whoever might be in the leadership role and go, do you not see what's occurring? And it's because maybe they weren't provided those tools. And so I approach it with grace, right? I always go, hey, is this an education problem or is this an ego problem? Because that's usually what I run into in this industry. So I think by approaching the education side, and you're seeing a lot more training programs, and it's something that hopefully as we continue our relationship with the NAEMT that, you know, we can help get some of this training and just a switch of culture into the EMT classroom, into the paramedic classroom, because building more resilient first responders on the front end is definitely something in a smart business move in the long end, because they have more, they go further, they become more involved, and they have the tools and hopefully they bring that with them, that culture change, and they challenge the organization to change. And then you get this generational gap that gets a little bit smaller and a little bit smaller where people can start meeting in the middle and it becomes a little bit more of a fluid thing. And I think we're working very hard towards that. But if anybody does know in leadership, like, culture is the hardest thing to change in anyone, whether it be a person, an industry, or just an agency or a company. And so, you know, these are big things that we're trying to move, and they're going to take time. It's going to take some time to understand things and go, hey, how can we be doing this better? And that's where the research and the numbers really kind of come to shine. And I hope that we can continue to do that. So great topic on that one. What do you have next for us, Brett?
Yeah, I think that actually was a great segue into what I want to get into next. And that's just talking about what the feelings are that people are having and what they look like for, you know, when they're starting to have issues with their emotions and starting to need some of that peer support. Feelings and emotions are a continuum. And we don't really look at it that way, or at least I didn't when I first started getting involved in any type of mental health care. But think about, like, you're annoyed about something, and then whatever's making you annoyed doesn't go away, and that annoyance kind of turns into anger, and then you kind of just live in that angry world for a little while, but the problem still doesn't get solved. And now you're enraged, right? Now you're so mad, you're seething and you just can't deal with it. That one's easy to understand, but think about, you know, you're apprehensive. There's a new change and it scares you and you're just not sure how it's going to work. And that apprehension, it turns into fear. And then that fear turns into terror. I actually just saw a really good example last night of this in a Netflix miniseries called Dracula. And it turns out that Dracula can be in the sunlight. Crosses aren't going to hurt him. And none of the things that we think about are going to kill Dracula. But even he doesn't know that, because because there were myths that turned into fear that turned into his reality. And that's the same continuum that's happening in this mental health world. It's a little problem that doesn't get addressed that then turns into a bigger emotion that maybe people recognize but think, you know, they're going to get over it, that now is that PTSD problem and it's permanent. Or, you know, well, I hate to use the word permanent, but it's something that's going to take a much longer time to unfold and get through and get past. But if we can address those apprehension level, annoyance level, I'm feeling a little sad today level versus I'm actually having thoughts about killing myself level of emotional damage, that's where we're going to be successful in those early stages. So what does that look like? People get a lot of tension when they're uncomfortable or they're not processing their emotions well. They can't sit still. They get up, they're walking around. I know that after the worst call I've ever been on in my life, I walked down from the second floor of that house out the front door. I took my ballistic vest off. I threw it on the front yard and I paced circles around the yard for a minute until a very good friend of mine got a hold of me and said, come sit in the back of the ambulance with me for a minute. Don't do this in front of the men. And I wasn't out there screaming, yelling, hollering, but I was, you know, obviously super stressed and just, I didn't have control of myself for a minute. And he got me in the back of the ambulance and allowed me to calm down and just talk for a minute. And that was huge for me. He recognized it. He saw that I was at my threshold. I couldn't take anything anymore in that moment. Everything around me was like, I was hypervigilant and every bit of stimulus was just, I felt like I was being attacked, you know, and just to get me into the back of the ambulance, which to me in that moment, that was such a safe space for me. Like the back of the ambulance is the most safe place that I work in, right? Other than maybe in the station, which isn't all that safe if they're throwing firecrackers and the practical jokers that I work with. But you know what I mean? Like the ambulance is my safe space. And for him to have the forethought to take me there and just say, hey, man, like take a deep breath, that might have saved my life that day. I can't say for sure because I didn't go way, way, way down the wrong road, probably because of that moment. But sleep disturbances, fatigue, diet changes, nausea, reoccurring memories or dreams, general negative feelings, like not just about the incident, but about everything. Like the things that make you happy suddenly aren't making you happy. Something's wrong. Blaming yourself. And isolation. If you're not someone that already isolates yourself and you're not like super introverted and you just need that, you know, few minutes a day or a few hours a day by yourself, and all of a sudden people are taking that time, I have a concern. And I'm going to bring that up. And when I bring that up, I'm not going to use open-ended questions if I have concerns. I'm going to use closed-ended questions, which is odd for us in this industry. I'm going to ask questions like, are you okay? And I want a yes or no answer. You know, are you thinking about hurting yourself? I want a yes or no answer. In fact, if I don't get a yes or no answer, I'm asking the question again until I get one. I need to know the answers to those questions. We have to get there. And then we have to build some goals, right? So now we know what they're suffering with. We know what they're going through. We've put ourselves in their shoes. We've maybe put some words to the emotions that they're having. What can we do next? Well, we need to try to calm the mind. Maybe change the attitude a little bit from like, I'm completely out of control to I can handle this. Get maybe being able to sleep and getting into some of those coping mechanisms, we all have coping mechanisms. We all have good coping mechanisms. We all have bad coping mechanisms. Here's the thing with coping mechanisms. I'm okay if you have bad coping mechanisms that you use in your life. And I'm not telling you that when you're going through a time of intense stress, it is not the time to try to get rid of those bad coping mechanisms. It's just also not the time to rely solely on those bad coping mechanisms. So if you're the type of person that gets off a shift and goes home and has a shower beer, when you're done with this stressful event, go home and have a shower beer. Just don't go home and have a shower case of beer. I just don't want those bad coping mechanisms to be taking over all of your coping strategies. Now's not the time for that kind of work. So take the good coping mechanisms, take the bad. When you're talking to someone that's in this type of stress, there's a lot of techniques that we can use to have to continue the conversation, because that's what needs to happen. You know, better out than in is the general rule of thumb when it comes to peer support. If you can get the emotions out, it'll allow you to let go of them versus put them in that box where you lock them up and let them rear their head the next time you're feeling that emotion again. And there's a lot of methods for that. And a lot of methods that we don't use with our normal patients, like silence is a really good tool, not necessarily over the phone, but in person, when someone could tell you something that was just absolutely devastating to them and they can see the nonverbals on you that just say, wow, that sounds terrible, but you're not saying that yet. You're just literally giving them the silence to get it out and let it be in the air. Huge tool. You can't let that silence fester forever. They're going to think you're ignoring them, right? But like letting it get out there, letting them say, you know, in their own head, like, I said it, I got it out, because that's a victory. They might not realize it yet. You might not realize it yet, but that's a victory. And then you can get into things like restatement and paraphrasing. I'm not really, really great at those particular skills. With one exception, I try to take the information, and if they're not putting it into words that my mind can understand, especially when it comes to their emotions, I will rephrase it back to them and say something like, I understand that call was really hard for you, and it sounds like you might be angry about this. And then it gives them a chance to say, yeah, you know what? That is what I'm angry about. And now that's a success. Now I got them to say, yes, we found it, right? Like we found at least a piece of the cause. Here's an emotion that we can assign to it. They're having anger and it's over this part of it. Now we might have to do that over and over and over again as we get through the story and find out where the sad piece is, where the hopelessness is, where the helplessness is, but we can get to that through paraphrasing and restatement. One of my favorite things to use is reframing, because I think it's so important. We beat ourselves up over these calls that we associate as being negative so much, and we feel like failures when the outcome isn't what we wanted it to be. And the fact of the matter is 99% of those calls, we didn't fail at anything. In fact, when somebody's walking me through some of these calls and telling me the things they did, in my own head, I'm not even on the call and in the emergency situation, I'm like, man, I wasn't even thinking about that. I wouldn't have even done that on that call. You did such a great job. So being able to take their words and them saying, you know, this is how I failed the patient. And you can take that and say, no, actually, this is where you went above and beyond every single expectation I would have for anyone else in this industry. And this is where I saw all these amazing successes that I think are going to make you a better provider or prove that you're such a good provider, and turn some of that loss into a success. It's going to be very hard for them to see that. But if they can start hearing that early, in the beginnings of these stressful events, it's going to be really, really helpful. And then the last thing that I really want to touch on for this segment, and I know we're kind of running long on time, is just expectations for an outcome once somebody's having these sort of problems. Someone isn't going to come to you, or even if you go to them because you see that they're struggling, and have a single conversation with you and just be like, oh, everything's better now. That might happen once in a blue moon, but that's not how most of these are going to work. And that's not a failure of peer support. So first off, don't give yourself vicarious trauma because you didn't feel like you solved someone's problem in the first conversation, because that's very rare to happen. What I want to see is improvement over the course of about 2 weeks. I want to reach out to them maybe once a day for the first couple of days. Hey, how are you doing? That's all it needs to be. And the response can be, you know, I'm doing good, I'm not, whatever. And then you build off of that conversation and just see how they're doing. If they're having trouble sleeping and they're having those nightmares and like they're getting to the point where they're having a hard time struggling with those like basic daily activities, and you hit that 2 week mark and that's not getting better, I'm very concerned. Now I'm really thinking this needs to be more than just a peer support conversation. You might need to think about talking to a therapist, and I'm going to start making those suggestions by the 2 week mark. Because if you don't get ahead of it, or at least starting to get ahead of it at that 2 week mark, once you hit that 30 day mark and they haven't had improvement, you're looking at clinical diagnosis of PTSD and a much longer road. So having the emotional intelligence to see that this isn't being effective and not having too much pride to tell someone that they're going to need a little more than you, which is hard to do, by the way, and not feel like you're just telling somebody, hey, man, I think you're kind of crazy and you need professional help. You know, like that's what it feels like you're saying to someone when you're suggesting a higher level of mental health care. And that's a really difficult conversation to have, which is a whole nother topic that I want to talk about in the future. Chris, throwing it back to you if you have any questions.
No, I really loved that second half. It's been great. You had a lot of good things there. One thing I wanted to kind of ask you, and it wasn't necessarily a question that came up in the chat, but it's a question I have. When you talk about these coping mechanisms, right? Because I feel like a lot of us just may not have been equipped with really good coping mechanisms. I do think, like, you know, going back to the education and training, whether it be new hire, whether it be initial training in EMR or EMT basic courses, you know, getting those coping skills. How do you think agencies can help foster, you know, good coping skills and strategies within their organization?
Oh, you know, I actually had a really difficult conversation about this recently. With somebody in a college class that I was taking, because he was pushing that all public safety needs to have mandatory physical fitness requirements as a part of their resiliency training. And I said, well, but that's not what everybody does. That's not everyone's form of resilience, right? So it's really hard to have a blanket good coping mechanism, you know, policy at an organization. We talked about culture earlier. What you need to have is a culture that supports all of the good coping mechanisms. So, you know, saying, you know, if you're fire-based and your EMS is in the firehouse saying, hey, it's okay to take off your uniform and get in the gym while you're on shift. that's supporting a good coping mechanism, right? Maybe if you're in a, place and you have a station where there's a kitchen, that that kitchen table, that fire is really good at that kitchen table dinner chat, right? Like whether it's been a good day or a bad day, they break bread together, cook a meal together, do the dishes together. That's the culture we need in all of public safety. You know, most of us, I think here today, are coming from an EMS background. So we don't have that fire department kitchen table, and the police, they get none of that. They're stuck in a car by themselves. They don't ever get to, you know, the only time they're seeing other officers is when they're getting backed up on a stressful situation. How do we bring that culture into that realm? That's the big question that we have to solve here.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, when you look at correctional officers or dispatchers, you know, they're isolated all the time.
Yes.
And I do like how you kind of put that. You know, it's not a blanket statement of saying physical fitness is going to be everybody's coping mechanism. I don't think that's going to work. What I do believe is providing them suggestions, right? Like, hey, you guys, we're going to put yoga mats in every firehouse and every EMS station, so you guys can do mindfulness. We're going to create a mindfulness room. So if you want to go in there, you know, because some of the stations can be loud, you know, there's radio traffic, there's people doing other things, other projects, but also allowing them and saying it's okay. Just like when they have time to PT, most of the time, like, you're not getting any blowback from leadership on, oh, you're going to PT, go right ahead, have a good time, you know, work out, get in the gym, you know. But we also need to say, like, hey, it's okay if I just want to sit here at the kitchen table and maybe paint or color or, you know, practice mindfulness techniques. If I just want to read in a quiet room, like, that's okay. It's not them being lazy. It's not, we have to provide those options, you know, and support those options. But you're right. It's not a one size fits all. There's a lot of people out there that just don't get drawn to physical fitness, but maybe they like to read or paint or play a music, you know, an instrument, you know, things like that. I think we just need to foster that culture where it's okay to do one of these things. It's like, instead of saying like, hey, it's required that you do 1 hour of physical fitness every, you know, every tour or every day on shift, it should be, hey, you have 1 hour of mandatory wellness, whatever that looks like.
And that was my literal next response was, you know, we work in an industry where, you know, we almost pride ourselves on, I can eat a meal in 3 minutes in the passenger seat, or while I'm driving, because, you know, we don't get lunch breaks and we don't get, you know, well, you know what? Maybe we should get a 30-minute break every 12 hours or an hour every 24 hours where I know that I can have decompression. Is it possible that if the entire city implodes and the world is on fire, that I might have to get pulled out of that break once in a rare while? Yes, of course it is. It's the nature of the beast, but it doesn't have to be the nature of the beast every day you walk in the door. And to give somebody that time, you know, roughly halfway through their shift, I don't care if you take a nap. I don't care what you do with it, but that's your time to just take a minute and be you. God, I would
check in with yourself
for that early in my career.
Check in with yourself, you know, check in with you, do some emotional reflection, work on yourself, you know, give them the tools. You know, sometimes people don't have the tools. It's like, okay, I get this hour. Like, what am I supposed to do? Okay, well, here are some suggestions, you know, and that's where Mind the Frontline comes in. That's where other programs come in, but that's where, you know, a really dialed in peer support program comes in and brings it, you know, holistically around, you know, the encompassing issues all around, not just, you know, hey, emotional struggles, coping techniques. It's how can we do these different things? But I do have a good question in the chat I want to field to you real quick before we kind of close out. You know, Sam is asking, you know, hey, do you mind quickly just going through a quick 1-2-3-step process of how to direct things and give support when you do have a peer support call that first comes in? You know, what is Brett's kind of 1-2-3 real quick high level? Because I know we're going to get into this in a future episode. But, you know, from a 1-2-3 standpoint, you know, if I have someone call, you know, hey, I'm having a bad day. You know, and I've gotten these, you know, where they're, sometimes they're intoxicated, sometimes they're under the influence, sometimes they're just hysterical, they're having a panic attack, anxiety is really stepping in, sometimes they're just depressed and really quiet, you know, but What have you found real quick, high level, 1, 2, 3, you know, I get a call. How do I respond to that as a peer support individual?
So number one, let them tell their story. Don't interrupt them. Let them tell their story. That's absolutely step one. Let them get it out. Number two, get a grasp of where they are emotionally. Is this a venting session because they know that they're stressed and they're just trying to get this out and they just want somebody to hear it? Or is this a plead for help? Because that's the change. That's where step three is going to be different. One and two, always the same. That's what you're doing. Let them tell the story. Let's figure out where they are. Step three is going to be getting them what they need. And that's either allowing them to have that conversation with you, which we're going to do no matter what, right? But is step three going to be, hey, I need to get you these resources and you need to get involved in this extra help? Or is step three simply, I'm really glad that you called and we had this wonderful conversation and I hope that you're feeling better. And if you need anything else, please feel free to reach back out. And if you don't mind, I'm probably going to touch base with you in a couple of days and just make sure that you're doing okay. Does that answer that question?
It does for me. And I believe it was a pretty good, pretty good answer as far as what we're trying to get after on that initial phase. And, you know, we've all been there. I think it is important to allow them to talk. You know, sometimes we really want to inject our experience or, hey, I've been through that too. You know, and I find myself early on and I still do that every now and then, you know, and I got to catch myself and go, Chris, come on, just shut up.
It's in here every single time because I've been doing this so long, I've experienced it. And I want to just railroad you like I just did to your conversation and tell you all about my experience. But it's
it's not about you. It's about them.
And if I had a dollar for every time my wife told me that, I'd be a millionaire, right? Like,
yeah. And I'm getting better. And that's the thing. I think for you peer support people out there, just know, like, it evolves with experience, you know, just like as I'm always personally and professionally growing, I'm always growing as a peer support responder and a supporter. You know, there's some days where I get to execute it just like I execute a fine call. And there's days where, you know, I may not be on my A game, which kind of brings me into my next little thing as we kind of close out. You know, once you kind of start getting in, also check yourself. You know, do you have the capacity to take this call? Do you have the ability? Are you in the mindset? A good example being, you know, sometimes I'll get a call and I'll know it's from our peer support hotline, but I'll know that I have stress and life going on. You know, kids might be my high school. Something is going on to the point where I know I can't bring my A game. And so I have to check myself and just let it ring on to the next person and just round robin it through the rest of the team. And that's okay. It's okay that I can't answer every call that comes in, but I want to make sure that I too am at my peak function when I'm answering these calls and making sure that I can provide and more importantly, listen and provide the best support I possibly can following up. And I love how Brett, you brought in the follow-up, right? So having a mechanism to continue to follow up on these individuals and track them, and not necessarily track in a bad way, but you know, there needs to be some sort of process, whether you get off the phone and you set a reminder on your Google calendar, because what I have seen a lot of times from peer support teams is the follow-up just isn't there. And, you know, great execution on the front end, bad execution on the back end. And sometimes, you know, that first conversation, like Brett said, you're not going to be healing or trying to change anybody. You're just trying to allow them the safe space to get this crap off their chest so they can get that backpack that's weighing them down. And then, you know, kind of guide them if they do need resources on what those next steps might be. But more importantly, sometimes things change within those first 42, 72, 96 hours. So having a good process, you know, here at Mind the Frontline, we use automation and technology very heavily in our back end to ensure, because we're human, we know that things drop off, we forget things, but we don't want that to happen. So we have put in place a lot of good tools to help us as peer support members to be able to follow up, to be, you know, remind us to make that call. And so whether you have a Google or a Yahoo, just something to set a reminder to, hey, follow up with this. And more importantly, when it goes off, actually do it, you know, and actually follow up with that.
And Chris, let me tell you, you want to watch somebody get emotionally broken, let them reach out to the people that are supposed to help them and then feel abandoned by the process.
And feel ghosted.
And they feel ghosted. They're never going to reach out for help again. They're going to go completely internal. And that's the time bomb of EMS. Those are those 50-year-old salty paramedics that all of a sudden one day are like, F this, I'm out. I can't deal with this anymore because they never got the support. And when they tried to get it, they're gone. And like, and then you never know what happened to them again. They're just gone forever.
And yeah, they don't and typically ask terrifying. Twice.
That's yeah. terrifying, you know, and now that's happening at a younger age, because that's one other thing we didn't talk about generationally about this industry. And I'm going to touch really quick. When I got into EMS and was getting paid to ride an ambulance in my 20s, I was the only 20 something at my urban agency working on an ambulance. The only reason I got the job was because the chief at the time was a Marine Corps vet. And when I applied and said that I was getting out of the Army, like in a few weeks, and I'd love to come work for your agency when I get out, he gave me the opportunity to come interview and basically told me, like, I'm going to give you this job, even though I would never give someone with your experience level and your age this job, but coming out of the military and like, it pulls my heartstrings. I'm going to give you an opportunity. The average age of my department was like 38 years old when I started. I'm still working for the same department and the average age is 26. The emotional intelligence of 38-year-olds versus 22-year-olds is huge. You know what I mean? So that's another big difference about when we got involved versus the folks that are getting involved now. You used to have to volunteer your butt off until you proved that you had the grit to go work somewhere. Now there's not enough EMTs and paramedics anywhere. The minute you get out of school, congratulations, we got you a job, pal. In fact, not only we got you a job, but we'll work you to death if you want to.
Yeah, you start tomorrow, you know, yeah. We're not going to give you any tools of resiliency. Yeah. We're just going to say, you know, because it is, it's a business machine at the end of the day. But I do like how you kind of put that, you know, we are seeing the average age of departments and agencies across the United States. You know, they're coming down because you're getting these younger recruits. The older individuals are leaving sooner, not staying as long. And more importantly, you know, we're seeing that turnover, right? So, hey, I've been a medic for 8 years. I got into it when I was 20. And then guess what? Now they've moved on. They've gone into nursing or they've gone into some other career because, you know, maybe this was not for them or they just weren't treated with compassion and allowed to basically do what everybody else and all the other industries are doing, which is recognizing, you know, hey, people are emotional. They're human. They have good days. They have bad days. And we need to be able to support that. You know, I think it's, at least my perspective or my opinion is, you know, EMS, fire, public safety just didn't have the tools to deal with it. And so they just turned a blind eye to it. And now is finally caught up. The pandemic definitely broke us. And in order to turn things around, we're gonna have to work even twice as hard, but doesn't mean we can't work at it. Doesn't mean we can't change it. And so, with that, Brett, any closing thoughts or closing remarks before we wrap up to the show?
I should have thought about that beforehand. no, not really, other than just keep your eyes open to the folks that are around you. Peer support starts on the street level. If you're still working the street, you know the way that the people around you act. And when they're not acting the same, it's okay to just go up and ask them if they're okay. And that's where this whole process starts. And if we can make that happen across this industry, it's going to be better for everybody. And I think that's probably the biggest takeaway for the new MHRO program that NAEMT is putting out, that I think it's simply keeping your eyes open and being aware that this is happening. Because if you have the emotional awareness to what's going on around you, people can start that healing process much earlier. And that's where the value is going to be.
Love it, brother. And I really thank you for your time today coming on. We look forward to having you back for the next episode and some follow-ups. With that, everyone, I just want to leave you just one more thing. You know, when we talk about Peer Support Unplugged, practical strategies for effective communication, we often talk about we have two ears and one mouth. I also want to throw in that we got two ears, we have two eyes and one mouth. So I would highly encourage using your ears and your eyes to be more effective. Look out for these individuals. You can see and feel and hear a lot. And that gets you, you know, at least halfway to tackling this battle that we're all out here striving to fight. And thank you, all of you out there that are doing this, whether you're an active peer supporter or you're just a silent someone in the background that does care about your team and that cares about the person that you serve next with. You know, all of you are making a difference. And I do hope that this episode wasn't half impactful. And we do hope to release the next date for the next month's webinar. So with that, thank you for being a part of episode one. Thank you, Brett, for coming on and being our guest and for all you do with Mind the Frontline. And for those of you that joined us today, we really appreciate your support. With that, my name's Chris, and you guys have a great day.
To our dedicated listeners, thank you again for joining us on this critical journey. Remember, the Critical Conversations podcast is a steadfast resource for police, fire, EMS, allied healthcare workers, dispatchers, air medical, and military personnel, along with their families. Your support makes the impact of these conversations resonate even further. If you found today's discussion enlightening and want to stay connected with our ongoing mission, please be sure to subscribe to the Critical Conversations podcast. You can find us via Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and the Mind the Frontline website. Your subscription ensures that you will never miss an episode, and it's a powerful way to show your commitment to fostering resilience within the entire first responder community. For more information and additional resources, visit our website at www.mindthefrontline.org. Together, let's continue these critical conversations and build a stronger, more resilient first responder family. We thank you for being a part of the Critical Conversations podcast. Until next time, take care, stay strong, and mind the frontline.